moral beliefs to shape our public lives. When I called Stephen a few months ago and asked him to come give the Kearney lecture, explain that he would be the second speaker, explain what we're trying to do with the lectureship, and how the Perkins School of Theology at SMU is trying to expand its outreach into the Dallas community, I was ecstatic when he said, yes, I want to be a part of that. I'd love to give this lecture. So we are so honored that he is here. This morning, Stephen will be speaking to us on the incredibly timely topic, religion, civility, and public discourse. And Stephen's going to speak for about 20 minutes, and then as he speaks, think of what he's saying that's resonating with you or intriguing with you, and we're going to have an expanded question and answer session following his remarks as he hopes to engage this wonderful audience. So let's give a big Dallas welcome to Stephen Carter.
Well, thank you, Talmadge, for that very kind introduction. I was excited at the thought of being here. I'm very grateful for the invitation. I'm grateful to SMU and the Perkins School, and of course to the Kearney family. And I'm frankly honored to be here for a day of lectures and discussions in Fred Kearney's name. I also, I want to thank you especially for that wonderful Dallas welcome, given that I'm a season ticket holder of the Washington Redskins. And you have to understand that my football support, my days as a football fan go back to the days when Dallas and Washington used to be fighting for first place instead of... Well, instead of what they seem to do now, put it that way. And in fact, I'm going to tell you a couple of stories in the course of my brief remarks. And one of them, which might be a useful starting place, is a story about football. But before I do, I should explain that when I say I'm going to talk about civility, audiences often assume I'm going to talk about being polite. My favorite theologian, Stanley Hauerwas, is fond of saying that much of Christian ethics has been watered down to God is nice, so we should be nice too. And I have nothing against being nice, but that's not actually what I'm going to talk about. Civility is deeply entwined with democracy, and it's also much understood, much misunderstood, I mean, within democracy. While civility in dialogue matters, and I'll have something to say about that, that's not all that civility is. Civility is, I like to say, the sum of the sacrifices that we make for the sake of living a common life. The sum of the sacrifices we make for the sake of living a common life. And to understand what I mean by that, let me again begin with a story about football, because this story actually is about also my children. I have two children, they're in their 20s now, but when they were very small, I decided one day that it was time to teach them about football, because they couldn't understand why on beautiful autumn afternoons their father wanted to sit in the house in the afternoon watching television. So I said, kids, you're growing up. It's time you learned about the mysteries of the adult world. Sit down. And so they sat there with me on the sofa, and we were watching the game, and I was explaining to them what was going on. And do you ever notice how you don't really understand something clearly until you try to explain it to a child? So something happened in that game that I was watching with the kids. It's happened in every football game ever played. And what happened was something like this. The quarterback threw a pass, which the receiver dropped. And it matters that the receiver dropped it. The receiver knew he dropped it because he was there when it happened, both teams knew he dropped it because they saw him drop it. The television audience knew he dropped it because of the replays that we saw, and the audience in the stadium knew he dropped it because of the replays on the giant scoreboard. In the entire Western world, in fact, the only person who thought he caught the pass was the referee. Now, this is in the days before the National Football League implemented instant replay review, and so when the receiver, having clearly dropped the ball, turned around and realized that the referee said he caught the ball, he jumped up and began celebrating as though he'd made the catch, and he ran back to the huddle for the next play. And on the sofa at home, one of my children, I can never remember which one anymore, said to me, but Daddy, he's cheating. I said, no, he's not cheating. You have to understand how the game is played. I said, but Daddy said, he's lying. He's not lying. He's just pretending something's true that's actually false. So. And the game went on. But subsequently, I thought about this. And so I raised this question with some of my colleagues at Yale Law School, where I teach, about if he was cheating. And they gave me some really useful answers. One of them said, I quote, he said, it depends on whether there is a meta rule requiring you to follow the rules. Until you have analyzed the meta rule, you can't tell whether not following the rules is cheating. I'm sorry, is breaking the rules, he said. And another one said, it depends on whether you interpret the rules of professional football according to a primitive hermeneutic of literal inerrancy. That's what he said. Well, I tell you that story for the following reasons. What's striking about what you might think was the sociology of football is that when the player was jumping up, pretending to make the catch what they hadn't made, he was doing actually what he's expected to do. In fact, had he done anything else, his own fans would have booed him. His coach would probably have benched him if he'd followed the rules. But instead, what he was doing was helping the team win. And if that required doing something that he was naturally permitted to do, well, it didn't really matter because his team was winning the game. That, for me, is incivility. Incivility arises at precisely that moment when, in order to obtain a particular goal, we decide that the rules that govern our common life are unimportant. There are many, many manifestations of this. I want to mention just two fairly practical and common examples. Think first about political campaigns and negative advertisements, attack ads, as we call them. Now, everybody hates them. The surveys are clear. Whether it's our side running them or the other side running them, we hate them. We think they are destroying democracy, and we're probably right. So the question then becomes, if everybody hates them so much, why do politicians keep running them? They run them because, although we say we hate them, we don't hate them enough to punish the people who run them. See, if we really hated them, we would say, well, if you run negative ads, even though I agree with you on the issues, I'm not going to vote for you. But we don't do that. We swallow our distaste and we vote for the guy anyway because we say, well, the issues are just too important. This election, like every election I've ever participated in, is the most important in our history. We cannot let the other guys win. They're far too wicked. Therefore, if you want to do some nasty things in the course of the campaign, that's okay. I understand. We got to beat those guys. In that sense, one way to think about it is that incivility actually succeeds, in a sense, because we often reward it. The second example I want to give, it's also a practical example from everyday life, is driving a car. If you're like me, you drive faster when you're running late. Now, if you think about that for a moment, if I drive faster, And the data are fairly clear. I actually increased the likelihood of having an accident, which would involve not only me but other people. So what I'm saying in effect is that part of the cost of me being late has to be borne by others who happen to be on the road, or as my kids would notice in the car, the people who I see as being in my way when I'm trying to get somewhere. My children used to tease me about how the fact that I'd always be sitting and saying, where are these people going? What are they doing on the road? Well, you see how the incivility arises. So what these two examples have in common with the football example is the refusal to make a sacrifice, a genuine sacrifice, for the sake of our common life. Now, the reason sacrifices matter, these little sacrifices, is because we have to make the bigger ones to make democracy work. It's important to understand what democracy is and why it's so valuable. It's not voting that makes democracy special. Almost every nation in the world holds elections. Indeed, you may not remember, but in the last Iraqi election before the American invasion, Saddam Hussein got 100% of the vote. Not 87%, not 94%, he got 100% of the votes that were cast, or so the government announced. It's not voting that makes democracy special and different. It's something else. It is what goes into the voting. Democracy at its best is a form of government that promises that we, the people, govern ourselves collectively. And what that requires is that we actually talk about it. That is to say, what makes democracy special is not the voting. It's the discourse that leads up to the voting. It's the conversation. It's the argument, sometimes vehement. But to make it democratic argument, the vehemence has to be tempered by a sense that we are all in this together. That no matter how we may differ on some important issue of the day, where you're screaming at the top of your lungs that you're right and I'm screaming at the top of my lungs that you're wrong, that at the end of the day, we are equally citizens and equally beloved of God, notwithstanding our differences, and need to treat each other, talk about each other, and most importantly, talk to each other that way. The skill that we're losing through our unwillingness to make sacrifices is that talking to each other across our differences. All the data suggest that more and more people are spending time with people who agree with them already. And this isn't just a matter of who our friends are. Residential patterns, even if you look, this fascinating block by block voting data for the last three national election cycles. And if you look at this data, what's really quite striking is how block by block, I mean voter registration data, block by block, you have not blue states and red states or blue cities and red cities, but blue blocks and red blocks. That we like living near people who agree with us. We hang out with people who agree with us. And when we spend all our time with people who agree with us, we tend to begin to take our convictions as self-evident. And one of the things that I think contributes to a kind of national sense of incivility is that if everything is self-evident, nothing needs to be argued for. If you look at people who disagree, if everything's self-evident, it's all obviously right, then if you disagree with me, there's only two possible reasons. Either you're an idiot or you're evil. And whichever of those categories you fall into, there's clearly no point in talking to you. And the reason I know you're either an idiot or evil is that everybody I know agrees with me. And this becomes an increasing problem because of the increasing ability through our technology to isolate ourselves from disagreement. So that our selection of which television shows to watch or which websites to read, oddly, gives us not more information, but less. Because increasingly, we gravitate to people who will tell us why we're right. We even often look to television shows and websites that will report the news as part of a process of telling us why we're always right and the other side is always wrong. There's a constant reinforcement of our own opinions, and that reinforcement makes it difficult or impossible to have reasoned disagreements. Bertrand Russell once wrote a great essay called In Praise of Idleness. In Praise of Idleness. And I like this essay, and not only because I'm lazy, there are other reasons too. In the essay In Praise of Idleness, Russell makes the following interesting claim. He says, in order to be a reasoning human being, we have to have times when we're not doing anything. And he said he really means not doing anything. He's not even reading a good book or just sitting around doing nothing. Because only when we sit around doing nothing, he said, does our mind begin to flow creatively. And the reason the mind has to flow creatively, he said, is if it doesn't, this is Russell talking, we will never have any ideas. We will only have other people's ideas. We will never make up our minds. We will always have other people make up our minds for us, he said. Now, we live enormously busy lives. It's difficult to carve out these moments of peace and solitude. It's difficult to imagine carving out moments of dialogue with other people. But if we can't do that, if we can't find ways to talk across our differences respectfully, we're going to lose our democracy. Talmadge Boston mentioned a moment ago that I was a law clerk for Thurgood Marshall, and Thurgood Marshall, in addition to being, in my judgment, a great Supreme Court justice, he was a great human being, and before he was on the court, he'd spent 30 years litigating civil rights and criminal cases all over the country, especially in the South and the Midwest, often at a risk to his own life. But when I got to know him, which was toward the end of his life, what was really quite striking as he told stories about those old days, he would talk about some of the famous segregationist politicians of the 40s and 50s and early 60s, and a lot of them he would talk about with affection. It was genuine affection. A lot of them were people he actually liked on a personal level. And he used to say, when we puzzled over how that was possible, he used to say I don't care, he said, what a man has to say to get elected. I care, can you do business with him? He said, I care when you sit down, and as he would always say, when you have a drink and play cards, but whatever may be the situation, which one is sitting down, can you reach a deal, make a handshake, and was his word good? And he went on to say that you could be wrong, even dangerously wrong, without thereby being an evil person. Now, for me, when I met him, I was 26 years old, and there, by definition, probably knew everything there was to know. I found that mysterious. I found the notion that you could be wrong on the crucial moral issue of the 19th century and still be a decent person. But I came to understand over the years the wisdom of that point of view. Thurgood Marshall believed in democracy, and democracy requires us to have the view across the sorts of issues that divide us, that people who disagree with us may actually have a point, that many times the reason the nation is so hotly divided is because the issues are hard, not because the issues are easy. That what the division may reflect very often is that people of goodwill can have more than one view. Now, each of us should have an issue or two about which we say, no, on this issue there's only one point of view. That's fine, that's an exercise of the moral sense. The problem is nowadays people have a list of 47 issues on which there's only one correct moral point of view. Now, I promised to keep this short because I want to have questions, but I want to talk for a moment about the role of faith in general and of Christianity in particular. So I've written over the years a great deal about religious faith and civility in the sacrificial sense. I wrote a book a few years ago entitled God's Name in Vain, and the subtitle was The Wrongs and Rights of Religion in Politics. And one of the things I suggested in the book was that religion as a force, and Christianity in particular, has through history been at its best when it's outside the levers of power, a prophetic voice, a critical voice, resisting the culture around it, insisting on its own particular and unique meaning. Christianity, like a lot of other powerful views of the world, has often been at its worst with its hands on the lever of power. And the reason for the difference, I think, this is to paraphrase Stanley Hauerwas again, is the difference between having the power to kill for one's beliefs, as it were, and the power to die for one's beliefs. There's the beauty of the outsider, of the critical prophetic voice, is precisely not having to rely on others to tell us what to think. C.S. Lewis wrote quite famously that the problem of a Christian political party is that it wouldn't win any elections if it was truly Christian, therefore it would have to compromise in order to win elections, and therefore it wouldn't be a Christian party anymore. And I think there's a lot to that. This is not to say that people of great faith shouldn't be involved in politics. Many are. It's not to say that people of great faith shouldn't be taking on issues in the public square. People absolutely should. But there's an enormous difference between the power to persuade and the power to control. And that outside prophetic voice is part of the power to persuade. The image of sacrifice, the image we associate, for example, with the religious strand of the civil rights movement, that image retained its power in our minds precisely because it's an outsider prophetic image. That's a way of doing civility too. Being the outside resisting voice is a kind of sacrifice too. It's not the only kind of sacrifice, but it's a kind of sacrifice that the tradition of Christian witness makes enormously pertinent and powerful, both in the lives of Christians and, one hopes, in the life of the nation. Whatever may be one's view in the end of the right way to exercise authority, whether persuasively or in control, the thing to bear in mind, I think, about civility itself is that it's not just discourse, but rather an attitude of being sacrificial toward our fellow citizens, and that it has to permeate the ways in which we interact. It takes work, it takes effort, it takes time, things we may have too little of, but without it, it's difficult to do democracy. It's easy to vote, hard to do democracy, because of that need to be sacrificial for the sake of our fellow citizens. One last little story, and then I'll stop because I've already gone over the 20 minutes that I said I was going to. There's a consequence to not thinking about the world sacrificially. I was mentioning to someone here who told me he's going up to Stanford that my wife and I once lived in Stanford when we first moved to Connecticut. She was, if you don't know Connecticut, Stanford is about midway between New York and New Haven. I was teaching in New Haven. My wife was practicing law in New York. She would get on the train in the morning and ride to New York with all the investment bankers and lawyers and corporate people. And I would get on the train and ride to New Haven with all the kids, because there are all these little private schools along the way, and these students from private schools would get on the train and they'd be riding off to their school. And so one morning, I was sitting on the train on my way to New Haven, and there were these kids sitting in front of me. They were teenage girls. There was a private girls' school on the way, very exclusive. A lot of the kids from the wealthier Connecticut towns went there. So they were students at the school, and they were chatting. And I couldn't help but overhear the conversation, in part because I was intentionally listening to it. And apparently, one of the girls lived in the town of Fairfield, Connecticut, one lived in the town of Westport, Connecticut, and they're both very wealthy towns, if you don't know Connecticut. And they got into this huge argument about which was the more exclusive town to live in. That was the argument. And so They started dropping names of famous person who lives in Westport, famous person in Fairfield, back and forth. Finally, one of them named a woman who at the time was one of the most famous rock singers in the world. And she says, well, you know, she said, she lives in Westport. That's the little girl from Westport said. The girl from Fairfield said, no, she doesn't live in Westport. She was just in Westport because she was visiting her manager. Her manager lives in Westport. And the girl from Westport said, how do you know that? And the girl from Fairfield, with this big smile on her face, says, because I met her when she came into my father's store. And she thought this was going to be the end of the matter. But the girl from Westport was far too poorly raised to let it stop there. Without missing a beat, she said, your father has a store? And the girl from Fairfield was crushed. She didn't say a word the rest of the trip. This is 20 years ago. Those girls are grown up. They're in their 30s now. They've got families. They're raising children. They may have important jobs. They may be bankers, lawyers, doctors. I don't know what they're doing. But that's the ruling class. And those are the values they're being raised to. And I do think, and those may be the values their children are being raised to as well. And that, I think, is really a choice. That's really the choice. That was a conversation not only without empathy, but without any sense of what I was just talking about, the sense of the love and mutual respect with which we look at each other. That's the generation of young people we raised already. There's another generation coming up behind them. Will we raise them to be people of sacrifice? Will we value civility? That's what we'll do. Thank you very much.
We want to have a discussion, and since I'm in charge of the Q&A, I get to ask the first question. Stephen, you've given us many things to think about, but being Dallas people, we'd like a little bit more direction about what exactly to do as Christians, recognizing the polarization in our society, the divisiveness. What do you see as your own and your fellow Christians' responsibility to take action toward bringing more civility into the public discourse?
I think that's an important question. I'll give you three very quick things to do, none of which will be entirely adequate, and they all start in the small. That is, I don't think there's a public civility program. The government isn't going to fix this for us. So three small things. First, to think about the example we set for young people in the way that we ourselves talk in a casual way about people who disagree with us on a particular issue. That's number one. Second, remember what I said about those negative ads? I would really like us, and it's hard. I know it's hard for me. I'm sure it's hard for many people here. It's hard for anyone who's passionate about politics. But I would like us to try to work to the point where we do decide if someone we agree with is going to run that kind of campaign that we won't vote for that candidate, no matter how important the issues are, because we will not vote for the candidate for the sake of our common life. That's a sacrifice, but sacrifice is what's important. The third is to actually carve out time somehow to talk to and listen to people who disagree with us, sometimes even have them at our dinner parties instead of as so often being surprised to find someone at the table who doesn't agree with whatever the group's view might be. The listen part is really important. I often tell my students, it's awkward at a law school what we teach there, but I always tell them the skill here is learning to listen with our brains instead of with our mouths, you see, which is too often when we say we're going to listen to someone's argument, what we mean is we're going to listen for the parts we can refute. That's all we're listening for is their errors because our minds are already made up. So those would be the three things off the top of my head, which I would mention. One is, as I said, thinking about the things we say, the example we set, especially for young people. Second, thinking about the way we vote and asking ourselves, do we want to take into account how people campaign? And third, really trying to find ways to make time now and then to spend time with people we disagree with sharply on various issues.
Until somebody raises their hand, I get to keep on.
Oh, there's
asking.
One over there.
Great. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. Fascinating. If you define civility as the sum total of sacrifice we make for the common good, I think that's your definition.
For the common life, yes, but
for
that's
the common wealth.
Yeah.
What do you say to those people who are so disenfranchised that they actually do not have a notion of the common good?
There's two different ways, for me at least, of approaching that. The first way is to look at the history of achieving through sacrifice. That is, again, if you take the example of the civil rights movement, what was striking about, and again, I'm talking about the public protest wing, what's striking about the movement was the courage of people, in many ways, had nothing or had very little, to stand up to the fire hose and the dogs and occasionally even the murders. That greater sacrifice, precisely by people who seemed to have so little, was part of what moved nation and changed a nation's conscience. Having said that, though, I recognize that's an enormously difficult prescription, and the other part of it is it's not so much to think about what to say to people who feel they're not part of the common life, it's rather how those of us who do feel are part of the common life can make them feel more as though they are. That is to say, it's not a prescription for people who feel oppressed, it's a prescription for people who don't, to try to find ways to bring people into the common life. Now, I want to emphasize, what I just said is not taking sides in any particular political battle. This is not a question of policy. This is a question of how we treat people and think of people and talk to people whom we see. I'll give you one tiny example of this is getting to know the names of the people who clean our offices, for instance. I know that may seem like a small thing, but I remember there was a fellow who was a custodian at the Yale Law School. He was a great guy, had a big smile for everybody, he was the warmest fellow in the world, and he died. And I went to his funeral, and there were a couple other professors went, one of the deputy deans went, but not a single student from the law school went. And that broke my heart, because he was always warm and friendly to students, and his funeral was two blocks away. It's not as though it was very hard to get to, and there was a memorandum sent around so everybody knew where the funeral was. It wasn't like I had to do any research to find it. I'm not saying everybody had to go to his funeral. I'm saying that making people feel, there are so many small ways that we can think about where people who may feel that they're outsiders, if we can't make them insiders, we can at least welcome them sometimes as though they are.
Yes, ma'am.
I also thank you. And as I listen to you, I'm a Perkins graduate, and some of my faculty members are sitting right here around me, and I kept thinking back to my theological education and wondering, where is your doctrine of sin? Don't we need, or do you view that we need a stronger sense of a willingness to admit that we too might be wrong, and that humility and that sense of our own limitation is a piece of what we have to reclaim publicly, in a sense, to be able to get to that place of civility?
Yeah, I'm very glad you asked that. This is something that I also have written about. I didn't talk about it today because of limited time. And I do think that it is important for all of us to recognize, except on, say, core issues of faith, that our convictions about politics, no matter how passionately held, are also, in a sense, always contingent. They're always tentative. We could always be wrong. We can always have something to learn. My friend Michael Perry, who's written about this a lot, says the fact that we could always be wrong is not a reason not to act. We've got to act on what we believe, but we should act also with somewhere in their kernel of that sense. There's a second aspect of the point about humility also and about sin. A friend of mine on the Yale faculty who's a Catholic is fond of saying that a sense of sin and of ourselves as people with an infinite capacity, if you will, for sin might help us to develop a different attitude toward the gotcha style of journalism when we think about the peccadilloes of public officials. It's not to say we shouldn't criticize people when they do things that are terrible, but this notion of when there's a confirmation fight, searching through someone's background to find the thing they did wrong suggests that somehow the thing they did wrong is the label for their life, instead of recognizing the sinfulness of human beings, the fact that all of us have things in our background, all of us are committing new things that if they were to come out in the newspaper or on television would make us look like terrible people the way that we tend to think of things now. To draw that distinction, so the humility in our own lives because of a sense of our own sinfulness is important, but also to recognize other people are sinful in that sense also, and so in that sense to be less harsh, if you will, at looking at the things that public officials may do wrong. Not because it doesn't matter what they do, it does matter, it matters a lot, but rather to recognize that you can do something wrong 10 years ago and become a different person, be transformed. Now we as Christians should certainly believe that.
I was raised by a very visionary Italian father, and the word we used at home was civiltà, and it started when we were children. We were not to gossip or to speak badly of people or to mock anybody. So my curiosity, it's stuck with me because it goes out beyond your home to your neighborhood and into the community. So I'm interested in what are the roots of your civiltà as a child, what your parents did to plant those ideas in you. I'm sure it started at home. I have a sense that it did.
Thank you for the question. I should explain that although I went to church when I was a little boy, it would not be right to say I had a Christian upbringing. Although my mother taught us, you know, now I lay me down to sleep and things like that, but that was about the limit of our Christianity at home. My Christian experience is largely as an adult. Nevertheless, it is true that one of the lessons that my mother in particular worked hard to teach us, that a lot of us tell our kids, is not to say something behind someone's back you wouldn't say to their face. And now I must say, I can't claim that I always live by that much as I would like to. But here's a, and in fact, I've had the experience of when my children were small. I remember once my wife and I were in the kitchen talking. I don't remember talking, but I remember my daughter walking through the kitchen, and as she overheard our conversation, as she walked by, she said, "Remember, don't say anything behind someone's back. You wouldn't say to their face," she said as she walked by, out of the mouths of children. But there's something else also, which is it's not just a matter, I think you're right, it's a deeper notion. It's not just a matter of not saying thing. It's a matter of reorienting how we think about other people. It's an enormously difficult thing to do. I don't want to say we should never be critical of people, sometimes even critical in ways that are vehement. It's just that vehemence has to be tempered with Christian love, with a sense of that person also as co-equal in God's sight. And I'm not saying that I do this any better than anybody else, but it's my aspiration to do it. And some of the people I've admired most in my life are people who genuinely are able to have that kind of attitude toward other people, including people with whom they disagree. There's the ability to accept the enormous capacity of human beings to think in a variety of ways, even when we think those ways are wrong, to accept that as a fact of our flawed and fallen humanity is also a crucial part of our commitment to civility.
Dr. Carter, thank you again. Appreciate it very, very much. If you would like to continue the dialogue with Dr. Carter, I invite you to the campus this afternoon at 4 p.m. for our academic symposium. Information is on the back of your program. Begins promptly at 4. Parking is available on the boulevard, so you have no excuse for not being there this afternoon. A couple of housekeeping items. Number one, if you would like to purchase a book, we have several of Dr. Carter's books outside for sale. There are folks at that table. Please take time to stop there and do that. And finally, you have heard about our faith and business luncheons. If you have an interest and have not been to one of those, if you have a business card, we have a jar on the registration table. If you'll put your business card in there, we'll put you on the email invitation list. Our next event is Monday, April the 18th, and we'll have a business person from the community, and that person is actually in this room. It's Rena Peterson, and our faculty co-presenter will be Dr. C. Carwan, who is also in the room today. Thank you very much for coming, and I appreciate it, and Dr. Carter will remain here for just about 5 minutes before I have to whisk him away to his room to prepare for this afternoon. Thank you very much.